on this edition for Sunday, May 23rd, a year after the death of George Floyd, a city searching for healing, and a country awaiting a reckoning on race and policing. Who do you think you are? And in our signature segment, the resilience of little-known record label Malico Records, next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. Tuesday marks 1 year since George Floyd was killed by a white police officer in Minneapolis. The brutal murder, caught on camera, led to the reemergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. It also spurred a summer of protests calling for racial justice around the country and the world. Last month, former officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of all three charges against him, including second-degree murder. And in March, the city of Minneapolis agreed to pay $27 million to the Floyd family in a civil settlement. On Tuesday, members of the Floyd family will meet with President Joe Biden at the White House to mark the exact day George Floyd was killed. In New York City today, one of George Floyd's brothers spoke at an event kicking off one of several organizations founded to honor Floyd's life and ongoing efforts towards racial justice.
You keep my brother's name ringing, you're going to keep everybody else's name ringing. Breonna Taylor, Sean Bell, oh man, Ahmaud Arbery, you could go through the whole list. There's a lot of them. But as long as we keep their names ringing, the face of justice will look like what it is now. Change.
We'll have more on the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's death after the news summary. Many Haitian nationals already in the United States will be allowed to stay after the Biden administration extended temporary protected status, or TPS, for 18 months. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announced the extension yesterday, reversing the Trump administration's effort to end the protection, which allows eligible recipients to stay and work in the U.S. Under the extension, an estimated 150,000 Haitians in the U.S. will be able to apply to stay, according to immigration activists. The TPS designation was originally given after the 7.0 earthquake in January of 2010, which devastated the country. In extending the designation, Mayorkas cited, quote, serious security concerns, social unrest, an increase in human rights abuses, crippling poverty, and lack of basic resources, which are all exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. The ceasefire between Hamas and Israel continues to hold for a third day today, but United Nations officials warn that the damage in Gaza will set the territory back years. The UN humanitarian coordinator for the Palestinian territory said 1,000 homes in Gaza were destroyed, and damage to infrastructure left 800,000 people in Gaza without access to tap water. During 11 days of fighting, at least 240 Palestinians and 12 Israelis were killed. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is headed to the region this week and said today that humanitarian aid for Gaza does not mean support for Hamas, which the U.S. designates as a terrorist organization.
We've worked in the past and we can continue to work with trusted, independent parties that can help do the reconstruction and the development, not some quasi-governmental authority. And the fact of the matter is, Hamas has brought nothing but ruin to the Palestinian people. It's gross mismanagement of Gaza while it's been in charge. And, of course, these indiscriminate rocket attacks on Israeli civilians, which have elicited the response that they did because Israel has a right to defend itself.
The president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, ordered a fighter jet to force a civilian plane to land in Belarus today. It was headed from Athens, Greece to Vilnius, Lithuania. On board was Roman Protasevich, a prominent opponent of Lukashenko and the co-founder of a messaging app used to plan recent protests. He was reportedly arrested after the plane landed in Minsk. Protasevich has been living in exile and faces charges that could carry a prison sentence of up to 15 years. Lithuania's president tweeted the forced landing and arrest was, quote, abhorrent. The Ryanair flight was crossing through Belarus airspace when it was forced to change course. Belarus officials claim they took the action because the plane was the target of a bomb threat. A European Union official tweeted late today that the plane was allowed to leave Minsk and headed to Lithuania with about 170 passengers on board. In northern China, 21 ultramarathon runners died when hail, freezing rain, and gale-force winds hit them during a high-altitude race yesterday. Chinese state media showed the runners starting out in mild temperatures, many wearing shorts and T-shirts. The 60-mile race took place on narrow mountain paths at altitudes reaching 9,800 feet. Race organizers claimed there were no predictions of extreme weather, but a local weather service forecast hail and strong winds for 3 days last week. Rescuers in winter jackets searched through the night. Today, they confirmed that 151 of the 172 runners were safe. Local officials said there would be an investigation and apologized to the families of the 21 people who died. For updates on COVID-19 and more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died after a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, held his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. The incident, captured on cell phone video, surveillance cameras, and police body cams, led to a jury conviction last month on counts of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. Sentencing is scheduled for June. NewsHour Weekend Special Correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro joined me to reflect on the past year. Fred, you've lived in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area for decades now. Besides the pandemic, how has this last year been different after the death of George Floyd?
It's like nothing we've witnessed here, Hari, or more accurately, nothing we've felt, because it's really palpable out there. And at this juncture, there is a real sense of severe exhaustion.
And what about the trial for Derek Chauvin and now the trial for other officers? Does this just kind of keep this at the surface?
It's been a very anguished time. There was a brief reprieve that came with the verdict that convicted Derek Chauvin. But then we go back and relive a lot of this with the federal trial of the four officers, with the state trial of the four officers that comes later, the trial as well cranking up with the killing of Dante Wright. And we're witnessing all of this amidst a crime spike. And in November, we will also see a ballot initiative that will ask voters in Minneapolis if they want to enable the dismantling of the police department.
What will be on the ballot? What is being proposed?
The Constitution of the City of Minneapolis requires a certain level of staffing in the police department. That will be removed if voters approve it. Well, in real life terms, just through attrition and departures, it's down a third of its 880 officers. And so the resources that it does have are very thinly spread amidst this crime spike. Now, critics will say that those are two completely different things. The crime spike is happening no matter what, and the understaffing, it's a separate issue in the police department. But in voters' minds, obviously, this is something that is keenly associated. And so the chances of the ballot initiative being approved, I would say, are not great based on the experts that I've talked to about this. And one more thing about the dismantling of the police, the substantial change that would be needed if you wanted to shift a police culture has to come from the state legislature. And the state legislature is a completely different animal than the City Council of Minneapolis. You have a lot of rural Democrats and especially Republicans who are very closely allied with the police in general and the police unions in particular.
Have there been any structural changes in this past year that people can point to?
I think you'll hear the city argue that it's taken some steps. They've banned chokeholds, for example. They've done things at that level. They are just now talking about eliminating traffic stops that inordinately target minority drivers, for example. You're seeing an increase in funding for an Office of Violence Prevention at the city, which is working to prevent some of this violent spike that we're seeing, especially in the north side, the predominantly black north side of Minneapolis. So there are changes there, but the fundamental shift in policing culture that protects officers, if you're going to change that system, you're going to have to go to the state legislature.
How are people there planning to mark this anniversary?
The aftermath of George Floyd's killing has seen an explosion of artistic expression. There are murals and extraordinary artwork everywhere you go. And I think it's healing for a lot of people. So that is something that is really quite noteworthy. And there will be observances. The Walker Art Center, for example, the very famous art center in Minneapolis, is free to the public on Sunday. So you're going to have a lot of that kind of observance and, I dare say, celebration.
Fred and Sam Lazaro joining us from Minneapolis. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Hari.
Early police reports and subsequent evidence presented in the police killing of George Floyd painted a contradictory picture of the deadly events that played out that evening nearly a year ago in Minneapolis, Minnesota. More recently, newly released video from 2 years ago after the death of Ronald Green in Louisiana paints another inconsistent picture. Green died in law enforcement custody after a car chase. And while incidents like these spark renewed calls for police reform, consensus on what that means is nebulous. I spoke with Philip Atiba-Goff, co-founder and CEO of the Center for Policing Equity and professor of African American Studies and Psychology at Yale University about these issues. In this last year, have we seen structural changes to policing in America?
There's two ways for me to take that question. The first way is, has the country changed? And I think that most people are frustrated by the lack of change that they see nationwide. And when we're looking there, it doesn't look like what we want to see. That said, there are lots of pockets that have done really remarkable things. We've seen the city of Berkeley end low-level traffic enforcement. City of Baltimore is declining to prosecute it. City of Ithaca just approved a plan to dissolve its police department and put together something entirely different, a department of community solutions and public safety that's majority unarmed, civilian-led, and won't send anybody armed to a nonviolent conflict. So I think what's happening is we're seeing piecemeal jumps forward towards what we're trying to do. And that's going to be ultimately unsatisfying when we're looking at it in a national lens, but it's going to create the models that make it possible to see full national change.
You have, what, 18,000 different police departments or jurisdictions, and what might work in a college town like Berkeley or Ithaca, will it work on the streets of a major American city?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Ithaca and Berkeley are not Philadelphia and St. Louis, and we shouldn't try to pretend like they are. When we think of policing, we think of NYPD and Chicago and Houston and Philadelphia, but the reality is 75% of those law enforcement agencies are 25 officers or fewer, and there's 1,000 that are just one dude. It's pretty much always a dude. So in that context, we're going to see really different changes in a city where there's 63 officers than in a city where there's 35,000. That might not even be the same job. I do think, though, that they provide models for how communities come together and say, this is how we keep ourselves safe. It may not be possible for New York to do what Ithaca just did, even though they're in the same state. It may be possible, though, for one borough or for one precinct to give that a shot, and that we scale up community by community and block by block, because that's honestly how crime works, right? Crime is hyper-local. It's not even like a neighborhood. It's one street corner within that neighborhood that's like 85% of the violence. So if crime works that way, why do we imagine that solutions to crime, solutions to poverty, solutions to the concentrated sets of disadvantage that make crime a more attractive reality, why do we imagine that that our solutions don't have to take the same kind of shape and the same kind of scale. I don't know why, but I'm going to tell you, we're going to be disappointed until we right-size those sets of things.
So how do you translate from, say, for example, if you could wave a magic wand and have every officer in all 18,000 jurisdictions of law enforcement agencies take implicit bias tests and understand that there are certain things that they bring to every occasion, how do you translate that into an actual cultural shift where we perceive one another differently day after day, incident after incident, which is really difficult?
Yeah, it is. It's so difficult that I don't know that we really want to try. Mm. Here's what I mean by that. The way you asked that question, it's a way I get asked a lot. How do we change the hearts and minds of officers to make policing better? And I think that's the wrong diagnosis of the solution. Rather than focusing on the hearts and minds of officers, or really the hearts and minds of anybody, let's focus on the behaviors, on the structures that we erect that overdetermine everybody's behaviors. We've known for better part of the last century that attitudes in general are really weak predictors of behavior. But if you want to change attitudes, the best way to do that is to change behavior. So instead of thinking about how do we affect the hearts and minds of officers, let's regulate the behaviors. They'll change their attitudes when they act differently. All of the science is clear. Behaviors change attitudes more quickly and more profoundly than attitudes change behavior.
So what are changes to behaviors that police departments could implement to hopefully change attitudes over time?
So my collaborator, dear friend and mentor, Jennifer Eberhardt, had a wonderful intervention in Oakland, where she just made sure that officers, every officer, before they engage in a stop, they have to write down, this is an intelligence-led stop. I have intelligence from this source that says this is a good stop. And the following year after they implemented that, they stopped 43% fewer Black people and crime kept going down. Now, that's not quite causality, but that's a pretty good start. In Las Vegas, they were having a big problem with their use of force after foot pursuits. And so Center for Policing Equity, the community, and Las Vegas Metro Police Department came together and said, hey, after a foot pursuit, my adrenaline's up, my heart rate's up, and I know you're a bad guy. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe I just slow down, count to 10, don't touch you until backup shows up. And the year after they implemented that, 23% decline. But the best intervention is no law enforcement showing up in the first place where they don't need to be. The last 25 years of doing this work, everything I hear from police chiefs is don't ask us to be school teachers, mental health experts, substance abuse counselors, homeless experts. And activists are asking for the same darn thing. Don't send a badge and a gun when the crisis is homelessness. Send a roof and four walls. Then you don't have to worry about them being better. You don't have to worry about them being there at all. Don't introduce a gun to a situation where someone needs shelter. It'll make a tremendous difference in how often we have to mourn our dead.
Philip Goff from Yale and the co-founder and co-CEO of the Center for Policing Equity. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Harry.
As a small, mostly unheard of independent record label, based not in New York or Los Angeles, but in Jackson, Mississippi, Malico Records has managed to outlast major record label competitors like Motown, Stax, and Chess Records. Referred to as the last soul company, it's been home to multiple recording artists and songwriters and has a catalog of original recordings and music copyrights numbering into the thousands. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker brings us the unlikely and long-lasting story of Malico Records.
From soul to blues to gospel, Jackson, Mississippi's Malico Music Group has seen and done it all. Now, after over 50 years, the story of one of America's oldest surviving independent music companies is being told.
Do you think the general population, the general music fan, knows of, and by extension, appreciates Malico's contribution?
No, absolutely not.
Rob Bowman is the author of The Last Soul Company, The Malico Record Story.
Mainstream America doesn't have a clue what Malico is. But for older Black soul blues fans, Malico's associated with an incredible run.
This run started in the 1960s. Tommy Couch was one of the founders.
In the early stages, we would try to make a record like a lot of other independent producers and studios. And we would rush to New York or LA or somewhere and try to lease it to a major. We could get nobody interested, so we had to put these records out ourselves.
Malico's early days were lean, but early in the 1970s, their studio recorded two big songs, King Floyd's Groove Me, released on Malico's Chimneyville label, and Gene Knight's Mr. Big Stuff, released by nearby Stax Records. The big stuff. Who do you think you are? Rather unbelievably, given Malico's longevity, the company and their labels never produced a number one radio hit in the pop music world. Only three of their songs cracked the top 50. The last one came from Dorothy Moore in 1976. Look like I kept you off of my mind. But year after year, Malico has survived, even as so many others shut their doors.
Everything's from Motown, Chess, Atlantic, Stax, glorious labels, every one of them, and you know, many more hit records than Malico. But none of them survived as long. They all ceased to be living entities, and they all stopped being independent. Malico has been independent 52 years straight.
Integral to their survival has been an ability to adapt. While it may have started with a quest for hits on the pop charts, this is not where the label ended up. Their move to a genre known as soul blues, and more importantly, gospel, is why Malico is still here. But you see, I come to tell you. In the world of gospel music, there is nothing larger than Malico, whether through their own recordings or acquisitions. In 1986, they acquired the Savoy catalog, making Malico the largest gospel label in the world.
When you think about the Black Church, you got to think about the music of the Black Church. And we're right at the top of that list when you look at the music. I mean, Reverend James Cleveland, Mahalia Jackson. So there's a lot of history throughout the years that, you know, we have, and we're very proud of.
Malico has blown the roof off gospel sales a few times. Mississippi Mass Choir's first album may have been the largest selling gospel album in history.
Released in 1989, the Mississippi Mass Choir's debut album became the number one spiritual album in the country and spent 45 weeks on the Billboard charts. But like every other corner of the music industry, the market for gospel music has changed. Much of Malico's business is now conducted online and through the streaming platforms. Malico has in recent years been digitizing and uploading all of their recordings.
From the most obscure track that sold virtually nothing whenever it was released. And the idea was, even if it generated $20 in streaming royalties in a year, you multiply that by tens of thousands of tracks, you can survive.
This archive created another benefit. It's increased the number of licenses and sampling deals for Malico. In recent years, their recordings have been sampled on songs by Kanye West, Drake, DJ Khaled, Snoop Dogg, and Cardi B. But Malico's been sampled for years, starting where so much of hip-hop started, with Grandmaster Flash.
And they have to get paid on that. But Grandmaster Flash recorded a song that he called Freedom, and actually, ironically, sampled a song by a Malico group called Freedom. And of course, that was back in the Wild West days of sampling in the early 80s, where nobody cleared anything. And if you got sued, maybe you paid something. And Malico was right on top of it, sued. I don't know what they got paid. Obviously, that's confidential. But that was the first sample. Later on, people like Celine Dion sampled Reverend James Cleveland songs. Pusha T has sampled Malico stuff. And one of the really great ones was Shaggy, Boombastic, one of the biggest hits of the 90s. And he's sampling a King Floyd song, Baby Let Me Miss Kiss You. Sookin' now, look at that. Baby,
let me do it to you, let me kiss you, baby. What do you think the story of Malico and its longevity says about the music industry?
Well, it says the music industry is much like capitalism in general. There are multi-levels, multi-tiers at which one can play the game. It operates the way companies operated 40, 50, 60 years ago, and I'm talking about small companies. But it's not like there are these old geezers who don't know what's going on. They're incredibly smart and have adapted to the industry, but they've never sold to anybody. They've been completely independent. They have nobody's expectations except their own.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
Finally tonight, there's a special place where props, those iconic and sometimes not so well-known items used in films, wind up when their on-set days are over. Next month, a company called Prop Store will auction some of its objects, including Indiana Jones's fedora and Harry Potter's glasses. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano has the story.
Once a traveler to a galaxy far, far away, this R2-D2 droid is one of hundreds of props going up for sale next month.
I mean, what could be more iconic for a Star Wars fan than to own an R2 droid like this? And it's valued at auction for $80,000 to $120,000.
From Star Wars droids to Harry Potter's wand and glasses to Indiana Jones's hat, the store's California marketing manager says the top props are expected to bring hundreds of thousands of dollars from collectors.
One of the hottest items in our auction is this original Indiana Jones Harrison Ford fedora hat from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the second film. This is valued in auction for $250,000 to $350,000.
But there are other items on the block that will be more within reach for movie fans, including props used in Batman, Terminator, Wayne's World, and Iron Man.
This is a great opportunity for any collector, especially a collector that is a fan of film, TV, any sort of media like that. We've even got pieces for comic art collectors in this auction. We've got something for every price range, from the hundreds of thousands to the low hundreds, such as these background shoes from the movie Elf. These will be in the lower range of prices. But the hope is that with 1,300 lots, anybody that's a fan of these films can come and walk away with something that they love.
The auction will be held online from June 29th through July 1st.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.